Blog Talk Radio.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, it is that time, 7 o'clock Tuesday night, time for another foray into the study of the Book of Acts. I'm your host, Andy Young, coming to you from Columbus, Ohio, here on Blog Talk Radio. I hope everybody had a wonderful weekend. I know I did. We had great weather here in the Columbus area over the weekend. I myself have been in the process of recovering from yesterday. Spending a day at Cedar Point with the family. For those of you who may or may not know, Cedar Point is a theme park, amusement park, here in northern Ohio. It's about an hour west of Cleveland, and it's right out on Lake Erie. And we went up there yesterday with my family, spent the day up there. I'll have to tell you, spending a day at a theme park with five children is very, very different spending it with your friends, say like with perhaps when you were in college or high school. Very different experience altogether. The good thing is everybody found something that they enjoyed. Everybody got to ride on something that they enjoyed. It was a real wonderful experience for my wife and I, getting to see our kids enjoy the amusement park rides for the first time, getting to ride on the roller coaster for a first time, even watching some of the little ones being brave enough to try a ride that I wouldn't have ever, never expected them to enjoy, and being so brave to do it. So I just got it was a big thrill for my wife and I, just watching our, seeing our kids enjoy that and getting to experience that through their eyes. So that was made for quite a long day for me yesterday, and I pretty much spent today getting to sleep in a little bit, just kind of resting and recovering, walking all over the place yesterday, carrying this five-year-old around on my shoulders for part of the time. So I'm sure some of you can appreciate and can identify with that. So here we are tonight. We're back here on Blog Talk Radio for another lesson in the Book of Acts. The phone number, if you'd like to be a part of the program tonight, is area code 347-855-8317. Again, that's area code 347-855-8317. If you have a Skype account, you will notice there on your program screen there is a button you can click on to link to your Skype account with the program. That is a free connection for you with your Skype account. Our email address is mail@ttanc.com. That's mail@ttank.com. Feel free to email us any comments you have, or you can even scroll down to the program to the bottom of the program screen, and you can enter comments down there on the program, questions, comments, anything you'd like to discuss pertaining to tonight's lesson, or any of the lessons for that matter. Go ahead and take your Bibles tonight and turn to Acts chapter 20. Acts chapter 20. We get started here tonight, as always, let's do a brief review of where we left off. Last week, our major theme last week focused on the assembly. But last week, we looked at a different kind of assembly. This was a public assembly. This was not an assembly of believers. This was assembly, the ecclesia, in the true meaning of the word itself. It is a secular word. It is not a religious word. It is a secular word that refers to a group or a body of individuals that have been gathered together to serve a particular purpose, a specific purpose. And this was generally used as a political term for an assembly of people that were gathered together to debate or discuss some pertinent legislation, perhaps, or a judicial proceeding of some kind. So this was a secular term, and so we saw how this word assembly was used in the context of chapter 19 last week, this ecclesia, particularly with regard to this individual who was a maker of silver shrines of the image of Diana. Diana being the major Greek Roman goddess that served that had a special significance right there in the city of Ephesus. And we saw how the disciples had been dragged into the theater in Ephesus and were more or less put on mob trial there in the theater. And we came to see how this mob of people behaving in a riotous, unruly manner actually consisted an illegal assembly. These assemblies, these ecclesias, had to take place in an orderly fashion in order for them to be lawful. Otherwise, those people themselves could be charged with rioting and could be found guilty and suffer charges or imprisonment because of what they were doing if they were to proceed in an unlawful manner. And so we spent some time looking at that last week, and we come to the end of chapter 19, and the first verse of chapter 20 picks up right at the very end of that incident that we looked at last week. So if you have your Bibles and you're in Acts chapter 20, tonight we're going to be looking at verses 1 through 12. As we get into chapter 20 tonight, we have this whole series of events that are briefly mentioned here at the beginning of the chapter. So our lesson tonight isn't going to get too heavy. We sort of have a bunch of little housekeeping items to address here at the beginning of this chapter before we really get into the meat of the chapter itself. So without any further delay, let's just dive right into our lesson here. Like I said, this picks up right where we left off at the end of last week's lesson. We have the assembly in the theater being dismissed. The riot has calmed down. The people are going away. They realize that they've got nothing there for which to be concerned about. They don't even know why they're there in the first place. And so we saw the town clerk had dismissed the assembly and everyone dispersed. And after everyone dispersed, chapter 20, verse 1 picks up. So follow along with me as I read. And after the uproar was ceased, Paul called unto him the disciples. These would be still there in Ephesus. Paul called unto him the disciples and embraced them and departed for to go into Macedonia. When he had gone over those parts and had given them much exhortation, he came to Greece and there abode 3 months. Now, please pay attention to this word again, much exhortation. This is a very familiar word to us. This is the word parakaleo. Parakaleo. It means exhortation or consolation. It literally means to call beside. Again, to picture, if you will, coming alongside somebody, putting your arm around them, bringing them near you, walking beside them, going along with them, encouraging them, comforting them, doing whatever that person needs. Being an encouragement to them. Okay, Barnabas was known as the son of consolation, the son of parakaleo, and the one who consoles, the one who exhorts. And this word again here is used in verse 2 of chapter 20. This is used in a very similar way in the context of another word that we have studied. And that word is the word episteirizo. Episteirizo. And of course, we have this prefix epi, which means thorough or complete or more so, and the word stemme, which has to do with standing or staying in place. So you get this idea with the word episteirizo. You have this idea of further stay or establishing further, causing them to be even more grounded, standing firm, okay, more solid, all these different ways that we could interpret this, whatever it is that helps you grasp the meaning of this word. When used in this context with parakaleo or exhorting, we've seen this word episteirizo used before in other places. In fact, just a couple chapters ago. You can look these up on your own if you want, but in Acts chapter 18, in verse 23, we read, "And after he had spent some time there, he departed and went all over the country of Galatia and Phrygia in order, strengthening all the disciples." And now that word strengthening there is this word episteirizo, establishing further. Okay, this, of course, is a reference to Paul at the beginning of this third missionary journey that he is now on. He left Antioch and is going back through Asia Minor, and this time he's going through Galatia and Phrygia, finding these assemblies of disciples and strengthening them, encouraging them, episteirizo, further establishing them, helping them to become more solid in the things that they've been. Another place this word is used, Acts chapter 15, go back even further to Acts chapter 15 in verse 32. We read, "Judas and Silas, being prophets also themselves, exhorted the brethren with many words and confirmed them." Here we have both of these used words, exhorted, parakaleo, and confirmed, also translated strengthened, is this word episteirizo. This idea of encouraging and establishing further, helping them to become more solid in those things they were taught. Even same chapter, Acts 15, verse 41, talking about Paul. He went through Syria and Cilicia, confirming or strengthening the churches, episteirizo, further establishing. And go back even further than that, Acts chapter 14, verse 22, we read, "Confirming the souls of the disciples and exhorting them to continue in faith." So you can see how it's common to use these two words together in the same context. Parakaleo, exhorting, episteirizo, confirming or strengthening. These words are very used interchangeably here, and they're very closely related. So in our text then in chapter 20 in verse 2, in these few verses here at the beginning of the chapter, briefly describe Paul as going back through Macedonia. He now departs from Ephesus. You remember he sent Timothy on ahead, okay, and Erastus, Timothy and Erastus, there was two of them. He sent Timothy and Erastus on ahead to prepare the way ahead of him. And now Paul leaves Ephesus, and he's going back through Macedonia. This would include Philippi, Thessalonica, and Berea. And we looked at several major events that took place there in the second missionary journey several weeks ago. But Paul goes back through Macedonia, back to these assemblies there, doing the same thing he had done with the other assemblies on his second missionary journey, and has also done thus far on this third journey. Again, reference back to Acts 18:23. The very same thing that was recorded there in Galatia and Phrygia at the beginning of this third missionary journey. going back through areas he had visited earlier on earlier journeys, and further grounding them, making them more solid, helping these disciples to stand firm in what they were already taught. And so he goes up to Macedonia, he goes to Philippi, he goes to Thessalonica, he goes to Berea, working his way down south to Macedonia, and eventually he ends up in Greece. So this would be Athens. You will recall the time that Paul spent in Athens debating the people on Mars Hill, debating with the Stoics and the Epicureans, debating with those of the Areopagus, okay? These people who were known as the philosophers who would come to Mars Hill. These guys would debate there. They were known as Areopagites, all right? And there were some of these Areopagites after Paul got done speaking. Some of these people came to him quietly afterwards, and they wanted to talk to him about that way, the teachings about Jesus, wanting to know more. Okay, there were notable individuals there. One of them we pointed out was one of the Areopagites. Another one was the wife, probably, of a notable person there in Athens, very well-known individual, the wife of this well-known individual, who also became a believer. And it seems that these many people there in Athens were saved, and as a result, assemblies that were formed there in Athens, assemblies of these believers would have gathered together, they would assemble themselves. And notice that here in chapter 20, that Luke doesn't reference Athens specifically, but the larger geographical region of Greece. So we can probably assume this to be indicative of the spread of Christianity throughout Greece, coming as a result of those assemblies started there in Athens as a result of Paul's debating there on Mars Hill and so forth. And so now you have disciples found all over Greece, all throughout Greece. So we get to the next paragraph here, and the next paragraph actually starts, we left off in the middle of verse 3. So let's pick up there and look at this next section, starting in the middle of verse 3. And it reads, "And when the Jews laid wait for him, he was about to sail into Syria, he purposed to return through Macedonia. And there accompanied him into Asia Sopater of Berea, and of the Thessalonians Aristarchus and Secundus, and Gaius of Derbe and Timotheus, and of Asia Tychicus and Trophimus. These going before tarried for us at Troas." And you notice the "us" there. Okay, it appears as Luke is including himself in the "us." He's writing in the first person plural. So it appears at this particular point in time, Luke is actually accompanying Paul on this journey. He's writing it from his first person perspective. Now, keep these names in mind. Let's look at these names here. I find it interesting to kind of go back. And you can do a search through the New Testament and just do a search on these names and see how many times they come up in the New Testament, in the various letters that Paul and Peter and others have written. It kind of gives you a little bit of insight. Not a whole lot is said about some of these guys when they are mentioned, but it kind of gives you a little bit of a window into the affinity that Paul and the other apostles had for many of these guys, how important they were, how well-known they were, the fact that they're even mentioned in the closing of the letters. These are very personal words that are written by these apostles to these assemblies in the various cities. And so to mention these fellows by name, I think it's just indicative of how close a relationship these people all had with each other. despite their vast distances apart, all the assemblies in the various cities all seem to know who these people were. And so we have this first person, Sopater, mentioned. He was from Berea. And of course, again, this is to point this out, indicate, you know, shows the result of the fruits that Paul has reaped from his work done in these cities. You have these individuals mentioned in each one of these cities that Paul has visited. Berea, we have this individual named Sopater. Nothing else is mentioned about him in the New Testament. But we have Aristarchus and Secundus from Thessalonica. Again, another city there in Macedonia. Another city that Paul had visited on his second missionary journey. Aristarchus, you can find his name mentioned again in at least four other places in the New Testament. He's mentioned here in Acts 19. He's mentioned in Acts chapter 27, verse 2. He's mentioned in Colossians 4:10. And he's also mentioned in Philemon, verse 24. I said chapter 19. That was actually last week. I'm losing track of what chapter I'm in. But in Acts chapter 19, Aristarchus was one of the individuals mentioned who was taken into the theater of Ephesus. You remember when all the silversmiths first started rioting and they were getting the people stirred up, they were looking for Paul. And they couldn't find Paul, but they found Aristarchus and Gaius, because they knew that they had been traveling with Paul, and so they drug them into the theater. Remember that? Aristarchus is mentioned as being a fellow laborer with Paul. He even accompanied Paul, and we're going to get there eventually at the end of the book of Acts, as Paul is being taken to Rome to appeal his case to Caesar. We learn that Aristarchus is one of the individuals who's accompanying Paul to Rome. And then we even learn in another epistle that Aristarchus even finds himself in prison with Paul at some point, at one time. So Aristarchus is a rather significant individual here in the New Testament. Nothing else is mentioned of Secundus. I don't think that it should be indicative of his importance or not, but at least in the letters of the apostles that we have included in our biblical canon, he's not mentioned in any of those. From Derbe, we have Gaius and Timothy, and you remember that Paul and Silas met Timothy at the beginning of their second missionary journey when they were coming through Derbe and Lystra. That's where they met Timothy. Gaius, as I already mentioned, was the other individual that was taken with Aristarchus in Acts chapter 19, taken into the theater in Ephesus. And if you read the book, the epistle of 3 John, you will find that the epistle of 3 John is written to Gaius. It's a short little letter giving some brief instructions, a brief letter of encouragement and exhortation from the Apostle John to Gaius. So later on you might want to go back and read that and see what John, just refresh in your memory what John had to say to Gaius, this man, this individual from Derbe. Tychicus and Trophimus from Asia. They were Asians. This is going to be a general reference to Asia Minor, probably more likely, possibly Galatia or Phrygia. Possibly that Paul met Tychicus and Trophimus at the beginning of the third missionary journey when he passed through Galatia and Phrygia first before he came to Ephesus. Tychicus is mentioned in the book of Ephesians. In Ephesians chapter 6, verses 21 and verses 24, Tychicus' name comes up. In Colossians 4, 7 and verse 18, his name comes up. Tychicus is mentioned in 2 Timothy 4, 12 and also in Titus 3, 12. Tychicus, it appears, became one of Paul's secretaries. And that's not to be a derogatory term. Most of the letters that Paul has written, you'll say, were written by Tychicus. It's believed that Paul had trouble with his eyesight. And so he didn't necessarily write his own letters, but he would dictate them to someone, and that person would then transcribe it for him. And it appears that Tychicus was that person. He wrote the letters for Paul. He even, in some cases, was the person who actually delivered them to the recipient. He would be the messenger or the courier. So we get an idea here of some of the things that Tychicus was involved in. And then lastly, this individual named Trophimus. Trophimus is mentioned only two other times in Acts chapter 21, verse 29, which we'll get to in a couple weeks, and also in 2 Timothy 4:20. Trophimus' name is used in conjunction with a major point of controversy that we're going to come to in a couple weeks' lesson, where Paul returns to Jerusalem after the end of the third missionary journey, and he is accused of being in the temple with Paul. Of course, this would be a big deal for the Jews, for the very devout Jews, because Trophimus is a Gentile. And here is this, and here Paul is accused of having this Gentile in the temple with him. So that's where we'll see Trophimus' name come up again. Now, I bring that up to point this out here at the end of verse 3 here in chapter 20. We have this little phrase that says, the Jews laid in wait for him. The Jews laid in wait for him. Now, with everything that we've discussed with Paul along these various missionary journeys, what's the same thing he's encountered in just about every city he's gone into? He begins disputing with these Jews in the synagogues, these devout Jews, most likely very influential religious leaders, very well-schooled academics, elitists. Everywhere we go, we see these Jews in particular trying to stir up trouble for Paul. And as of late, it doesn't seem to be working out for them, because the Lord informs Paul, I've got your back, Paul. There are people here who are going to look out for you, who are going to be on your side. And we've seen it played itself out in several different ways here in recent weeks, where everywhere, even though there's trouble for Paul in these cities with the Jews, it doesn't last very long. The local government officials there are on Paul's side, and they make it possible for Paul to continue on what he's doing, and it kind of diffuses the whole situation between Paul and the Jews. And so we find out here this reference, Paul is getting ready to return home. We have this reference of sailing into Syria. Syria is that northern province north of Jerusalem. In Syria is the city of Antioch, which is the city where Paul has always departed from at the beginning of these journeys. He's got these major group of assemblies in Antioch. And Paul is planning on returning to the city of Antioch in Syria, because that's where he started from. So when it says he's going to return to Syria, this is a reference to him returning to where he started from on his voyage. And he learns that the Jews are waiting for him. Somehow they figured out, or they're anticipating Paul returning to Antioch in Syria, and so they're waiting for him. They're waiting to get him as soon as he comes back, as soon as he comes back to their turf, where they don't have to worry about Gentile governments interfering with what they want to do. So apparently Paul learns of this plot, that they're waiting for him. And so instead of going back to Antioch directly, look what he does here. He just backtracks. He went to Philippi and came down through Macedonia, down to Greece. And now what he does is he works his way back up. So now he's in Greece, and now he goes back up to Berea, Thessalonica, and back up to Philippi. All right? So he's just retracing his steps back through Macedonia, and that's where we find him as we pick up the next paragraph in verse 6. Okay, look at verse 6 with me now. And we sailed away. There again, look at that. First person plural reference. Luke is apparently with them on this journey. He's writing from first person. We sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread and came unto them to Troas in 5 days, where we abode 7 days. And upon the first day of the week came together to break bread. Paul preached unto them, ready to depart on the morrow, and continued his speech until midnight. And there were many lights in the upper chamber where they were gathered together. Now, do you see this reference here in verse 6? You can see he's backtracked up to Philippi. And now from Philippi, he takes a boat and travels across the northern part of the Aegean Sea up there, over to Troas, after the days of unleavened bread. And if you remember all the things that we've talked about before, the days of unleavened bread is this 7-day feast that's part of the Passover. Okay? You have the Passover, which is commemorating, obviously, the Passover, the 10th plague of the death angel when Israel was held captive in Egypt. They observed the Passover, and from the time they left Egypt until the time they got down to the Red Sea, or until they got down to Mount Sinai, they ate unleavened bread for 7 days, because that's all they had with them. Remember, they had to get all the leaven out of their houses. The leaven was symbolic of sin, so they had to get all the leavening out of their house, all of their bread, all of their starters. Their sourdough starters, perhaps, something similar to that. They had to get rid of all of it. And so they had no leaven. So for 7 days, if they wanted to eat bread, the only bread they could eat was unleavened, since they had to get rid of all their leaven. They didn't have any starters made. So all they could eat was unleavened bread. So this became a feast, a commemorative feast for them, along with Passover. So every year you would celebrate Passover at the beginning of the first month. And then for 7 days following Passover, they would eat unleavened bread to commemorate them fleeing from Egypt. Okay? Notice, please, that they observe Passover there in Philippi with other believers. That would include both Jewish believers and Gentile believers. Isn't that interesting how you have this one body of both Jew and Gentile? Okay? One body of Jew and Gentile fellowshipping together, observing Passover together. And not only Passover, but the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Okay? I think that's pretty telling. How important the importance of that. I mean, I think that's significant. So after that feast was over, they sailed to Troas. And you'll remember that Troas was the point from which Paul and Silas and Timothy, they kind of had a roadblock there. Remember, they tried to go into Galatia and Phrygia, and they met some obstacles. So they were resisted in the spirit. They couldn't go up there. And so they went down to Troas. And while they were in Troas, you remember that Paul had this vision in the night. And in his vision, he saw a man of Macedonia praying that God would send someone to them. And so that was then the motivation for them the next day to depart from Troas, to go over to Macedonia for the first time. And they landed in Philippi. So now they're back in Troas, and look what we find in Troas. Lo and behold, we have disciples in the city of Troas as well, even though we never had read or studied about any ministry that Paul had in Troas. And why is that? I think we can assume that these believers here in Troas are a result of Paul's ministry from Ephesus. You recall we had this one little blurb several chapters ago that made mention of Paul having a ministry there in Ephesus, and as a result that all of Asia heard the word and heard Paul's teaching. And so I think we can include Troas as being part of this all of Asia. So these believers here in Troas are most likely going to be there as a result of Paul's ministry while he was operating in Ephesus and having this outreach to all the various regions of Asia Minor, including Troas. Notice that we have also this reference to the first day of the week. It says in verse 7, "And upon the first day of the week, when the disciples came together to break bread, Paul preached unto them." Now, think back with me for a second. Let's look first at this expression of breaking bread. And think back with me in Acts chapter 2, verse 42. What was the purpose for believers assembling? We said the purpose for assembly was for edification and for equipping. Edification, equipping, two sides of the same coin. Okay, edification. And that edification was accomplished in four distinct functions. You remember that? And those distinct functions were found in Acts chapter 2, verse 42. And they were instruction and doctrine, fellowship, that's the word koinonia, that means having all things common. Okay. What all did they have in common? They were all children of God. They were all born again, born of the Spirit. They were all new creatures. They were all baptized into Christ's body, both Jew and Gentile now, one body. So here we have fellowship, koinonia, all things common. Okay, breaking of bread, there we go. And the fourth one was prayer. Okay, so instruction and doctrine, fellowship, breaking of bread, and prayer. And so here we see in verse 7 this reference to breaking bread. Clearly, at least clear to me, this is my assumption, I don't think it's all that far off, we have this idea of these disciples in Troas meeting together on the first day of the week, assembling for edification. And that's alluded to here in this little phrase, gathering together to break bread. The disciples came together to break bread. See that? Now, we have this reference to the first day of the week. Now, let's not make more out of this than what it simply says. You look at that verse, and just look at what that verse tells you. There is no mandate here. You see that? Read this carefully, and you will not necessarily find a mandate for the when of fellowship, for the when of gathering together for assembly. Okay? It simply states, all Luke is telling us is, these guys in Troas met on the first day of the week. You see that? Nothing more. That's just when they decided to assemble. It almost seems arbitrary. I don't see anything in here that necessarily speaks of a mandate, as if that's when we're supposed to. We read that verse and these guys met on the first day of the week, so that's when we're supposed to meet. Not necessarily. It's not a bad idea. There's nothing wrong with that. But I don't see anything dogmatic about that in that verse. Okay? So I just want to point that out to you. Now look at this. At the end of verse 7, it says that Paul preached until midnight. He continued his speech until midnight. You talk about having complaints about a long-winded preacher, okay? All right, imagine yourself sitting in a church And the preacher gets up and at 11 o'clock in the morning, and he preaches until midnight. Okay, can you imagine that? All right, I know that's just a little bit of a humorous thing to consider there. But Paul preaches until midnight, but these people willingly stay to learn from Paul. Okay? They're staying there willingly to learn from Paul. It says that they met in the upper chamber. The upper chamber. And this is the word huperuo, same word that was used in Acts chapter 1 when the disciples met in the upper room. Do you remember that in the upper room after Jesus ascended to heaven? The disciples, the apostles and the disciples were gathered together in the upper room. Same word here. Okay, this is a reference to the third floor of a house. This was very common in this culture. We saw that in Jerusalem, in Israel, in that culture. Probably this is a influence of the Greek and Roman culture, because we see that same type of dwelling here in all of the Roman Empire in these various Gentile cities. We have a house with three floors that would typically be, the first two floors is typically where the family that lived in that house would stay, and the third floor of the house would be a furnished guest room. A large furnished guest room. It could also be a converted rooftop. It could actually be the roof of the house with an enclosed area for a living space. But typically that was where friends or family or relatives would stay who would be visiting out of town. This large upper guest room would be reserved for important company like that. And these were frequently the locations where the disciples assembled for worship, for fellowship. Okay, you've got this reference here to many lights being in the upper chamber. Literally, they were burning the midnight oil. Okay, Paul was teaching; he was going strong, and there was no stopping them. They lit all the lamps in the house, so they had plenty of light. They had plenty of light in this dark upper room at midnight. Okay. Burning the midnight oil. All right, let's move on. Let's go on to verse 9. And we'll get through this last paragraph here. And this is probably going to be the meat of tonight's lesson, I think. Looking at what happens here. Verse 9. And there sat in a window a certain man named Eutychus, being fallen into a deep sleep. And as Paul was long preaching, he sunk down with sleep and fell down from the third loft and was taken up dead. And Paul went down and fell on him, and embracing him, said, "Trouble not yourselves, for his life is in him." When therefore he was come up again and had broken bread and had eaten and talked a long while, even till break of day, so he departed, and they brought the young man alive and were not a little comforted. And so here again, you got this reference to the third loft or the third floor of the house. Once again, confirming this idea of this upper room in the house being on the third floor. Now, this guy, Eutychus, is sitting in the window and he falls asleep while he's listening to Paul teach. And while I'm on this, let me take the time here to point this word out. Notice the way that the English translations render this word preaching. They call this a preaching. Reference to Paul preached, listening to Paul's preaching, while Paul was long preaching. You get this idea that's very familiar to us, of being this captured audience, all right, You know what it's like sitting in church on a Sunday morning. The pastor's got a captive audience. You're sitting there in your pew, and you're listening to someone standing in front of you, and he's got this there on the platform in front of the pulpit. Everything screams authority, lecturing us, as it were. Okay? So we buy into that orthodox understanding of this text, especially when they translated preaching. I mean, tell me, in past, when you've read this, and it says Paul's preaching, has that never conjured up in your mind Paul standing up in front of a pulpit, preaching to a group of people sitting in front of him, just like a pastor preaches to you in church on Sunday morning? Tell me that's what you don't usually think of. All right? So we buy into that orthodox understanding of this text. But look at the word here in the Greek, okay? It's the word dialegomai, or dialegomai, however you want to pronounce it. Dialegomai. Literally, to through say, or to say thoroughly. A better way to understand this is to have a dialogue. And when you're having a dialogue, what is that? This is a structured, reasoned discussion. This is the exact same word that was used of Paul in Athens, debating the Stoics and Epicureans on Mars Hill, right? This is not a one-way lecture. This is not an authority telling people what they should think about something. Okay, this is a two-way reasoned discussion, a dialogue. It's going back and diming two. It's going back and forth. Reasoned discussion. Do you see the difference here? Do you see the difference between this, between what is actually going on in the upper room versus what normally happens in the institutional church on any given Sunday? These are not the same things here. So let's put this orthodox interpretation out of our minds, this understanding that we have. When it says Paul is preaching, he's not preaching, he's dialegomai. He is having a reasoned discussion. This is a discourse, an interchange going back and forth between Paul and his listeners. He's speaking, they're asking questions, Paul's asking them questions, they're responding, Paul is trying to help them understand by asking them questions, leading them into a particular area of discussion, answering their questions, belaying their misconceptions. This is why I say, and you may have heard me say this before, because preaching, let's understand the difference between preaching and teaching. Preaching is for the unsaved, but teaching is for believers. Okay? Preaching means heralding. Preaching means giving a proclamation. It's a call out for people to be informed about something. Okay? We preach to the lost. We preach to the unsaved. We have a message about a kingdom, a message of salvation that they need to hear. We don't preach to believers. We don't preach to disciples. Okay? Disciples are learners. They don't need a proclamation. They need teaching. They need instruction. They need to grow. Okay? All that happens with dialogue. Okay, so they can grow. They don't need salvation. They are already saved. Sit back and ask ourselves, why? Is it any wonder why, when you sit in church, that you get preaching and not teaching? And it comes down to this. It's because the pastor thinks you still need it. You need to preach the gospel to yourself every day. It's because you need a daily resalvation. And so they preach to you the same message over and over and over again. And is it any wonder that people are leaving the churches in droves? And these pastors can't figure out why. You know, and I just commented about this on Facebook today. I came across an article someone had shared. Another one of these articles. Why are people leaving the church? Why? And you read these articles, and it's written by a pastor of some church or an elder or some Christian blogger or some discernment blogger or one of these reformed big dogs, all asking the same question. Why are people leaving the church? And you get all these answers. You read, you take the time to read through it, and they're all saying the same thing. And I just look at them and say, the answer is very simple. Duh, it's the theology, stupid. Okay? All right? It's the theology. And pastors can't figure this out. And the fact is, people are just tired of it. They figured it out. They're just tired of being told how worthless and sinful and depraved they are, especially when they read their Bibles and the Bible says, we have been born again, that we are saints, that we are children of the living God. Right? Those things don't mix. People are smart. They figure that out and they're tired of it. Right? We want to learn and grow. We are learners. We are disciples. We want to learn and grow and mature. And the church just doesn't do it anymore. If it ever did. If it ever did. All right, now I'm preaching. I know, I'm preaching. But I think you know this to be true as well. And this is why it's important for us to see the difference here. Paul is engaging in dialogue, teaching the disciples in Troas, answering questions, reasoning with them out of the scriptures, and this goes on until midnight. And Eutychus is listening, and he ends up falling asleep, and he falls out the window to his death. Can you imagine that? Oh, man. You have this expression, taken up dead. This literally this means that they picked him up and carried him away because he was dead. So make no mistake here, he was actually dead. Not just unconscious, actually dead. And it appears that they picked him up and they carried him back into the house. And they laid him down somewhere in one of the lower floors of the house. And Paul does this amazing thing. He falls on him. And the word here refers to embracing him tightly. And the word's actually said two different ways. I think for emphasis, he embraces him by embracing him. In a sense, is how this reads in the Greek. He holds him tightly and he wraps his arm around him, embracing him tightly. And when he does this, Eutychus miraculously returns to life. And he arises, and they give him something to eat. Notice this. This phrase is repeated. It almost seems redundant. It says, when he was come up again, look at this, and had broken bread and eaten. Now, usually breaking bread is a euphemism for having a meal, but the fact that he says broke bread and eaten, you notice that? It almost looks like if breaking bread is another way of making reference to having fellowship or edification. Remember the four functions? Instruction, fellowship, breaking bread, and prayer. And we've got this phrase, breaking bread and eating. It actually appears to me that after Paul brings Eutychus back to life, he has his own little fellowship meeting with Eutychus. Just him and Eutychus together. And it almost seems like there's one-on-one instruction going here with Eutychus. Because it says he breaks bread and he eats. I think that's interesting. And what else does it say? He talks to him for this long while. This word has more the idea of keeping him company. And I think that goes hand in hand with this whole idea of fellowshipping and instructing Eutychus. It's almost like Paul is having his own little assembly meeting with Eutychus. Right there. Maybe at the kitchen table as he's eating. And he's keeping him company. Paul is investing his time with this one disciple to make sure everything is all right with him. Just imagine the comfort that this was to Eutychus. And what does this say about the character of Paul? The genuine concern that he has for this man. And Paul has already been up till midnight, and he spends the rest of the night keeping company with Eutychus until morning. Until morning. Do you realize that Paul hasn't slept all night? And in the morning, Paul has to leave and catch a boat. He's got to set sail in the morning. He hasn't slept yet. Okay? And so we're coming to the... Now, we're almost done here. We're getting to the end of this lesson. And I just want to give you the number again, if you'd like to be a part of the program tonight. Again, it's area code 347-855-8317. If you'd like to call in and make a comment or ask a question regarding this lesson tonight, you can go ahead and start calling in now. We're getting close here. We'll be taking some questions or comments here in a little bit. I know that Paul and Susan usually call in, and Paul and Susan usually have a lot to contribute by way of comments that they make pertaining to the lesson, so we'll look forward to that in a little bit. So you can go ahead and start calling in now, 347-855-8317. So Paul leaves, and then they take Eutychus upstairs to the rest of the disciples. And what do you suppose the rest of the disciples have been doing this whole time, while Eutychus is downstairs with Paul? Praying, probably. Maybe. That would be perfectly consistent with the purpose of them being there in the first place, wouldn't it? Right? Remember, one of the functions of assembling was prayer. And we don't see any mention of any of those who were in the upper room being told of Eutychus' condition until they bring him up there in the morning. Now, I think we have to assume that they did know something. They must have known that Eutychus was alive. Did they get that news somehow? I mean, how did they take it? Could there be some, wow, is that really true? Almost too impossible to believe. You hear something and you want to believe it, but somehow there's that little kernel of doubt that's like, man, is that really true? Is he really alive? But when they finally see him, when Eutychus finally goes back upstairs to the third floor, to the upper room, and the rest of the disciples see him, imagine their relief. And Luke says, they were not a little comforted. Don't you just love the way Luke puts that? They were not a little comforted. It sounds so anticlimactic, doesn't it? And the English rendering there doesn't really do it justice, because if you read this in the Greek, it's a little bit more clear. It says, listen to it this way, their comfort was not able to be measured. Or it was without measure. Or you could say, their consolation was immeasurable. Now that's a little bit more powerful, isn't it? I think that says it a little bit better than they were not a little comforted. Their consolation was immeasurable. All right, that is a lot more emphatic. And so that brings us to the end of tonight's lesson. Like I said before, there wasn't too much meat in this lesson. We just had some housekeeping items to address here before we get into the real meat of this chapter. And so next week, we'll get into look more closely at the speech that Paul gives to all the Ephesian elders before he leaves for Jerusalem. So I'm looking forward to that. So at this time, we'll go to the phones and we'll take some callers, anybody who wants to call in. If you'd like to be a part of the program tonight and add your comments or be part of the discussion, the phone number is 347-855-8317. You can join us on your Skype account. Just click on the Skype button on your program screen. It is free for you to connect using your Skype account. You can send us an email at mail@ttank.com. It's mail@ttank.com. Or you can even make comments or ask questions on the program screen itself. Just scroll down to the bottom of the program screen, and you'll see a space there for you to enter comments. And once again, I think we've got Paul and Susan on the line with us. Paul's calling in. Hey, Paul, how are you this evening? You're on the air.
Pretty good. yeah, if anyone calls in, you can kick me off. I don't want to prevent anyone else from being able to call in. Really happy with the convenience of how the radio programming is working out for us, a lot more efficient. And so I'm really happy with it. I hope it's been an all right transition for you as well.
Yeah, it's been great.
And, anyway, yeah, thanks for the lesson tonight. That's an extraordinary passage of Scripture. And, what I'm beginning to see along with this passage and many others, particularly what's known as the, quote, Last Supper and all the detail there, we have a pretty good picture of what the disciples of the way did when they gathered together. And it was, a discourse. Interesting in that chapter, the first time, at least in the ESV, at least in my ESV, which is going to be based on a different manuscript than the King James, I believe. But the first time, the first reference to Paul's teaching is simply the word logos, Paul's word, And then I was looking at how it's used elsewhere in the New Testament. And then, of course, the second time it's mentioned about Paul's teaching is the word that you mentioned and what it means. Curiously, apparently the word logos has a pretty generic meaning that's determined by the context.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because in the context of that, let me see here, after upper Paul sent for his disciples, oh, wait a minute, when getting down here to where we were, on the first day of the week when we were gathered together to break bread, Paul talked with them. The word talked there is logos. And apparently, if you do, let me make sure I'm right on that. Let me see here. Oh, no. What was I looking at? intending. No, when Paul talked to them, what was I looking at? When Paul talked with them, having departed in the day, and he prolonged his speech. Yeah. Okay, so basically in verse 7, Paul talked with them. It's the word you mentioned. Okay.
Yeah.
And then intending to depart on the next day, and he prolonged his speech until midnight. Curiously, that's logos, and because of the context, it's interpreted with the same definition as the first word that you mentioned. And
that word at the end of verse 7 where it says he continued his speech until midnight, that is the word, like you said, again, that is the word logos. Meaning his speaking. He kept speaking. In other words, he kept talking or speaking until midnight. His saying.
Right.
But again, in verse 9, it says, as Paul was long preaching, it's that word diolegomai used again.
Right.
So in both places where the English renders that preaching or preached, it's the exact same word diolegomai, which has this idea of being reasoned discourse or dialogue, a give and take, a dialogue going back and forth.
Right. And, that's what it was. And, I think we have a pretty clear picture of how these fellowships, for lack of a better term, were run. And, of course, Paul was there so long. Now, don't you think he went so long because there was a lot to teach and he knew he was leaving the next day? So they were trying to kind of cram everything into one night?
That could have been part of it. But I think, in my mind, I think that there was, I don't want to say heated debate, but I think these people had so many questions. You know, just
right.
Think of the scope. I just think of the scope of what he was teaching them. You know what it's like when you get together. And you may have had professors like this in college, but you get a teacher that just has this unique gift of being able to relay the information and to open your mind and to someone who is able to motivate you to think. And they get you thinking, and you're just absorbing everything you're saying. But the more you hear, the more questions that brings up, especially if it's something that's contrary to what you originally thought. And so I'm thinking, you consider the fact that, they're coming from the Greek Gentile culture, these believers, and the things that Paul's teaching, and then trying to reconcile that with their culture. I'm sure these people, these believers, had all these questions and things they wanted to ask Paul. So you see this teaching going on, this back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and it goes on all night long.
Right.
It just continues all night long. Time flies. It's pretty much what it was. They were so engaged in this, and they were so engrossed, discussion going on. It went on till midnight. That's the impression I get from it.
Right. Well, and basically, I think that came from the culture as well. I think even before the way came along, synagogues were pretty much that way. Now, not necessarily
Let me put it to you this way. You and I both know what it's like. you know, you and I have gotten together and we sit down and we start talking about stuff, man,
right.
we could keep talking all night, you know?
Right.
Or even like, even at the tank conference last year when everybody was there gathered together and, you know, we had all those, we had all those, all that time after the sessions were over and all that time we spent together with you and Susan, John and Bo and everybody else who was there. We just sat down, we're eating dinner and these, we're having these talks going, and the talks, just, the discussions just keep going. You know, we could sit there and talk all night, you know? That's
yeah.
what it's like. You know, that's how it's supposed to be, I think. That's what the fellowship's all about. And it's a
dialogue.
Wonderful thing.
Yeah. Dialogue and, you know, just being in touch with people on a ground level. I think that's how it went down, and I think the institutionalization of that is just totally backwards. And I don't think, really, I've just come to believe the more I study that there is no room or merit for any kind of institutionalization at all in Christianity. Granted, you know, I have a very strong emphasis on Christians were organized according to gifts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And I think that's the real danger of, you know, the big struggle with the home fellowship movement is the danger of loosey-goosiness.
Right.
Okay? You know, everybody getting together and having a psalm and a hymn and pretty much
right.
what Paul dealt with at 1 Corinthians. And also,
mm-hmm.
if there's not organization, that's really, really bad because the organization is based on gifts. And, you know, gifts are not going to be properly utilized and put into practice if there is an organization,
mm-hmm.
you know. And
mm-hmm.
in the home fellowship networks of the first century, we see organization. We
mm-hmm.
see messengers. We see the recognition of specific gifts, you know, and how all that came together to work as one body.
Mm-hmm.
So that's important, and people really struggle with the idea that all of that can be done without authority. But it can be, the basis is agreement on truth. Okay, and, you know, we look at the first couple of chapters of Acts where those huge amount of people all came together, okay,
mm-hmm.
and there was a problem, and the apostles put out a recommendation to the people, and how many people were we talking about, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds, at least.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And I doubt there was some kind of meeting where there were like 2,000 or 3,000 people there. Okay? Maybe
mm-hmm.
there was,
mm-hmm.
but I kind of doubt it.
Mm-hmm.
But what does the Bible say? They were all in agreement. And
mm-hmm.
somehow or another, they came up with the seven guys they came up with.
Yeah.
Okay. So, that's my input. This is just a whole other way of doing discipleship, other than what we know.
Mm-hmm.
It really is.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think we have a lot of learning to do about how it all comes together.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's an extraordinary passage. It's you know, the hunger for the word, the Eutychus guy, or however you pronounce his name, he was probably a laborer just couldn't hold it together after 6 or 7 hours. But looks like Paul brought them back to life, and they went right back to fellowshipping until dawn.
Right.
So,
that was the original watch.
Yeah.
What was that?
Susan said that was the original watch night service. You ever heard of a watch night service?
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, I forgot you're Baptist. So anyway, I hold out hope. I know, not just hope, I know that kind of love for God's word and dialogue and learning God's word together, it's still there.
Mm-hmm.
It's still there.
Yeah.
But it's got to be part of it.
I know that's the case. Paul, you know, I know it exists, and I know it exists among people who are stuck in the institutional church. There are people who genuinely have a love for God's word, but you know they're so confused and so blinded by this notion of having to be part of this institution, and it's just stunting their growth. And I just want to tell them, like, do you realize how much better it could be? You have this hunger for the word and this desire to learn a thing, but why are you putting yourself? But you continue to put yourself here, and you continue to outsource your brain to these guys standing behind the pulpit.
And if you read what went on in these fellowships in the New Testament, and you look at the fact that at the institutional church, time to meet together, you show up at a certain time, and the service ends at a certain time.
Mm-hmm.
That in and of itself, you know, the hard line schedule, that in and of itself is so telling.
Yes.
You know, it's just so telling.
People lose their mind if the church service goes 5 minutes late.
What's that?
People lose their mind if the church service goes 5 minutes late.
They do.
You know, because they're not going to get they're not going to get their favorite table at the restaurant.
Right. And see, basically, the thing you got with a home fellowship, and I mean, a lot of times people want to get out of church because of, you know, the football game.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or some kind of Sunday football game. I'll never forget as an elder, okay, you know, Super Bowl Sunday, you know, was always the big test. The people who showed up Sunday night and missed the Super Bowl were the spiritual ones, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, we would tape it and not listen to the radio or anything and go home and mm-hmm. blah blah blah. Well, you know, with a home fellowship network, you know, you just meet a little early and have your meal and your lessons and then watch the Super Bowl together and eat some good snacks to boot. You
mm-hmm.
know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, a whole book could be written about all of the unnecessary controversies there are because church is institutionalized.
Oh, don't get me started on that. Yeah.
The list just goes on and on. The need for attorneys to draw things up. Again, I mentioned this last week, and I'll mention it again. As Reformed elders, our focus was administration. That's all we had time for. Okay? You know, children liability laws. The legalities and the finances and, you know, everything that goes into, I think we had elders meetings twice a month, I forget. And it was always all about administration and, the 10,000 square foot building and the 400 something thousand dollar a year budget. And just the administration of it, I can testify firsthand that as an elder, that's all we dealt with. Okay. I was just about barbecued, and hung out to dry on out in the front parking lot when I suggested as an elder that our yearly strategic planning meeting would center on, you know, Ephesians 4. Okay. And, I was darn near burned at the stake for it. And, instead some advertising expert was brought in, you know, it just is what it is, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we were considered one of the more cutting-edge Reformed churches.
Mm-hmm.
So, we could go on, and I guess we shouldn't. So, but great lesson.
Thank you.
Great lesson, thank and you. Again, just an astounding text of Scripture.
I heard Susan there in the background. Did Susan have any comments or anything that she'd like to add?
She doesn't.
No. All right. Well, we got a couple minutes here, real quick. Can you go ahead and just kind of give us a preview of what's happening Friday night? Kind of talk about that for a couple minutes.
Friday night, first of all, I want to apologize to everyone. I have not had time to keep up the radio scheduled, the pre-recorded radio schedule. I didn't have time to get up last week's schedule because I got to upload the MP3 files and set up the links, and the time just wasn't there. So there wasn't a radio schedule posted. It's from the week before. Those links will still work, but they're not new links. This week, nothing's going on this week except what I originally posted. Friday will be a live show, per the usual, we'll be revisiting Paul David Tripp's How People Change, and we'll be starting back in our overview of that book in the third chapter. And depending on how I overview those chapters will determine whether we have a fifth part on Paul Tripp's book, How People Change. The first two parts were history. Last week, I started getting into the end of the book, and we had to spend a lot of time in chapter two. We start in chapter three. However, I am holding that series to six parts. So at the latest, week after next, I'll be starting the series on the Heidelberg Disputation, okay? And, you know, that's really important. And so this week, the finishing of, maybe the finishing of How People Change, the rest of the chapters could go pretty quick, okay? But there might be one more week. But again, I'm gonna hold that series to six parts, which means at the latest we'll be starting the Heidelberg Disputation week after next, and that's extremely important because as I kind of poke around and I'm kind of nosy in regard to what Susan is working on in the conference. She's ordered quite a few books, and of course, she's going to be focusing on Jonathan Edwards at the conference. So basically, she opted out. I'm looking at the books that she's kind of looking through and deciding to read first, second, third, fourth, and fifth, and so on. And one book that she put at the bottom of the stack is entitled Jonathan Edwards and the Limits of Enlightenment Philosophy by Leon Shea. And so I picked that up, and I've been reading it, okay? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Andy, you know, all of this business with Jonathan Edwards is my bro.
Mm-hmm.
These people have no idea what these reformers believed.
Yeah.
Okay? The more Susan and I study, the more it is just so blatant that the Reformation was about world philosophy.
Yeah.
And this guy that wrote this book is not a Christian. He's a world philosophy scholar, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Jonathan Edwards is, by and large, noted as, you know, a 17th century philosopher.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so when you've got all this young, restless, reformed, whatever they call them, and I guess what's pathetic about it is John Piper and the likes, they know all of these people following them have no real idea what Jonathan Edwards believed, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's all an orthodox pretense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these guys teach theology that's completely predicated on world philosophy. And, you know, sola scriptura, or however the Latin is just got to be the biggest, fattest lie. It's just not about scripture. But anyway, yeah, Andy wanted to make sure you didn't have anything to add to the show.
No, but I'm finding some great stuff on Jonathan Edwards.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She's into Jonathan Edwards deep, and she may lose her mind.
Well, it can't be great stuff. It might be juicy stuff, but I don't think we can say it's great stuff, right?
Right.
Well,
I mean, we don't want to see anything. We don't want to see anything great about Jonathan Edwards, do we?
Well, great in the sense of, oh my word.
Yeah.
We are.
I know. I'm giving you a hard time.
This man for being such a theologian and the abuse of God's word, the. He used his congregation as psychology tools to work out a psychology of religion and how his sermons affected the congregation psychologically.
Mm-hmm.
He used his congregation as guinea pigs.
Yeah.
And was surprised when they were committing suicide because of his sermons.
Oh, I shouldn't laugh at that.
Crazy
it's just
stuff. And basically, if
we elevate him on this big pedestal and say, oh, our Christian school students, look at this man. This is who we are supposed to be.
They have no idea. People have no idea what this guy really believes.
Yeah.
Oh, don't get me started.
And it's the same, you know what? And it's just the same. It's just the same story recycled over and over and over again, year after year, decade after decade, century after century. And is it any wonder that we still see the same things happening and the same people are throwing their heads back and howling, woe is me, why is this happening? You know?
Right.
I've got to go get some stuff out of the park. That's a great lesson, Andy.
Okay. Thank you, Susan.
Well, that's all.
Well,
that's all we've got.
All right. Well, we'll bring it to a close then. We'll wrap it up. I'll let you guys go, and we will talk to you next week on the show, and we'll be in touch this week too as well. So thank you again for your comments tonight.
All right, brother. All right. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye now.
Okay, Paul. Have a good night. All right, and that wraps things up for our lesson tonight. We ran a little bit long tonight. I know we're not broadcasting live anymore at this point. I think this is still being recorded, so it might still be available on demand. So if you're still listening to me, thank you for joining us tonight and being part of the lesson. And please join us next Tuesday night at 7 o'clock, same time, same place, here on Blog Talk Radio. We'll continue on in our study of the Book of Acts. Until then, again, I'm Andy Young, your host, and you have a blessed week. Thank you.